Chapter 5. Life in Rajin. Life in Rajin slowly returned to normal, if one can speak of normal conditions at all during such a time. After the Jews had been driven out of their beautiful houses on the market square, and from the better areas of the city, a new Jewish quarter was established in the worst part of the city, where the poorest Jews already lived. This area contained many narrow streets, such as Kozia, Sholna, and Kalin. The Judenrat, under the strict leadership of David Lichtenstein, functioned well, considering the circumstances. It was composed primarily of highly respected members of the Jewish community. Also, the majority of the Jewish police were comprised of respectable young people. Compared with what one heard about other towns, the Jews of Rajin hardly had any reason to feel ashamed of their community leaders. But like almost everywhere else, we also had no particular reason to be proud. The people were irritated. Each day was more difficult than the day before, with Fridays being the worst. Every Friday the Sicherheitsdienst presented a package of decrees and laws to the Judenrat, which were to be imposed on the community immediately. The laws were to be put into effect within a week, since the new package always arrived on the following Friday. These detested decrees and laws were devised for only one purpose, to torment and decimate us Jews. With every new week, life became more burdensome and more unbearable. The work which was partly ordered by the Judenrat also became more intolerable because of the chicanery and excesses of some SS sadists who were usually involved. The number of attacks at night aimed at individual apartments increased. These often included robbery, destruction, and murder. One night, some SD people broke into the apartment of Mr. Scheinman. Eli Scheinman was a respectable Zionist Askam. His wife was intelligent and well-educated. His son was my friend and schoolmate. We grew up together. As they were being beaten by the SD people, Mrs. Scheinman resisted and allegedly slapped one of the SD men. She and her husband were shot on the spot. Their son, my friend, was able to flee, but was shot later too. I will never forget the long discussions we had as schoolchildren with that intelligent woman. May her memory be honored. 7 p.m. was curfew time for the Jews, when all gates and doors had to be shut. For the Poles, the curfew began later at 9 p.m. The rooms of our apartment, with windows facing the street, were blacked out so as not to attract the attention of the Germans. Night assaults were, however, quite normal. Often the Jews were removed from their apartments and placed in inadequate accommodations in the poor section of town. In the still of the night, the spiked boots of German patrols, consisting of 2 or 4 soldiers, could be heard clearly. As soon as they approached, all lights were turned off and there was a deathly silence. We breathed again only when the marching boots could no longer be heard. According to orders, we all had to wear white bands with a Judenstern on our right sleeves. Failure to comply meant the death penalty. Leaving an apartment and entering another house was prohibited. Despite this order, neighbors came together in their backyards to visit. Hardly anyone dared to go through the street, since the soldiers fired immediately. But what transpired in the back of the houses could not be seen from the outside. There we could read newspapers and talk about them openly. Radios had been confiscated a long time ago. Owning or listening to a radio was punishable by death. Backyard meetings took place almost every night, with the discussion continuing the next day at work, or whenever or wherever an opportunity presented itself. In this way, we encouraged and strengthened each other. There were several intelligent people in the town who dedicated themselves to this task, and in so doing provided help to many. They had neither bound themselves to this chore, nor were they organized. To help morally was simply the wish of all the people who suffered in this desperate situation. I still remember one quiet hero, Levi Levi. He was a shoemaker by trade, but also a self-taught man, an intelligent and religious, a Ben Torah, who often led the congregation on the holy days. His commentaries were well known and were balm to our hearts. We also knew that he was right in predicting Hitler's end. But in regard to the point of time, he was mistaken. Our house, too, was a meeting place. At night we sat together in semi-darkness. Among others, Mrs. Kalinka came with her son and beautiful daughter, with whom I had a brief love affair, which soon ended with her resettlement. Resettlement was the name of the deadly game. There was Benjamin Kupiec, a wood merchant, who lived in the neighborhood, and the Kavelblum family. We talked and told jokes which often brought tears of laughter. Every now and then a relative or acquaintance came from another town to spend the night. Then we told each other what was happening, comparing the cares and the suffering.
Benjamin Kopiech was fortunate to die a natural death from an illness. I also remember Benjamin's sister-in-law, the wife of Mendel Kopiech. She suffered the experience during a later deportation action of having her child smothered accidentally when she was hidden in a cellar hole, out of fear that the child's cries and sobs would lead to detection. When she was discovered and came out of the hiding cellar, the only thing she held in her hands was a flower pot. All Jews were subject to forced labor without payment. In the early morning, the groups of workers gathered in front of the Judenrat on Kotzierstrasse. Those who had a permanent position were practically treated as privileged Jews. They went mostly alone or marched to work in groups. The rest, the majority of those gathered, were linked up in rows according to lists by the Jewish police, who then led them to their positions. They were always accompanied by the Jewish police, the Polish police, or the Germans. The Judenrat made every possible effort to fulfill the demands of the Germans in order to avoid spontaneous Aktionen. Their success was only scanty and limited. It was impossible to prevent the authorities from exploiting and humiliating their Jewish victims as they saw fit. Depending on their mood and desire, they took Jews out of their homes, their backyards, their beds, and the streets, or wherever they saw them. They enjoyed showing the superiority of their race over the Jewish Untermenschen.
The work crews consisted of men, women, and adolescents. Sometimes they were mixed, sometimes separated according to sex. Some were forcibly recruited by the Judenrat. Some Jews were so poor that they allowed themselves to be given any work by the Judenrat in order to earn their daily bread. Moreover, this presented the only possibility of getting out of the Jewish quarter, come into contact with Christians, and perhaps find something to eat, since nothing was produced in the Jewish district. Those poor people who depended on payments from the Judenrat were especially vulnerable to arbitrary treatment. Anyone who had money was able to redeem himself from the Judenrat. Thus, automatically, a privileged class and nepotism developed. The families of the Judenrat members and the Jewish police were the most privileged and were exempt from forced labor. Consequently, hatred and hostility toward them increased. The people of the work crews looked poor and shabby. Their clothes were neglected and patched. Their pants were made mostly of dyed canvas. Fur trimmings were removed from their winter coats, drawn together with a string through the waist for warmth, or to smuggle a turnip or some bread back into the Jewish section. Women and girls who were not accustomed to such hard work developed rough faces, cracked lips, and swollen legs from the wind and bad weather. It was a pitiful sight, especially to see acquaintances who one was used to seeing quite differently. Only on Sundays, if it was quiet and no work was required, did they look at themselves in the mirror and try to restore the looks of their former faces as much as it was possible to do. Those who had redeemed themselves from the Judenrat were only safe from the Jewish police. Their redemption was hardly acceptable by the Germans, so they were forced to hide. No one could move about freely in the streets of the Jewish district during the day, and at night it was prohibited in any case. The insecurity never stopped, but was rather a permanent condition. Although Rajin was not a fenced-in ghetto with barbed wire, hardly anyone dared to leave the Jewish section. Venturing outside always brought trouble, risks, and even danger to one's life. It was especially risky for a Jew to walk past the houses of the Gestapo and other police officers, but also past the Rathaus, the castle, the house of Wikowski, or the former house of Catholic priests, which was across from the house of M. Apeloig, across from Gestapo headquarters. For no reason at all, a Jew could be taken in and would never come back. At best, one was made a target of ridicule and beaten. The general food supply was divided into three categories. Only members of the master race and their collaborators were amply sustained. The Poles got almost enough. We Jews were never regularly provided with food. Our rations were distributed sporadically, in much smaller quantities, irregularly, and only in exchange for ration coupons. The food we received was always of poor quality or already spoiled. We were condemned to starvation by both the legislators and the occupation forces. Those who did not want to starve were forced to rely on barter and smuggling. Jews were excluded from any social or medical care. Hospitals did not accept Jews. Medicine could only be obtained through subterfuge. Jewish stores were closed or confiscated and taken over by ethnic German or Polish trustees. Most Jews were removed from their former jobs. They were not allowed to accept a contract of employment. The jobs reserved for us were word cutting, carrying water, and similar menial activities. We lived outside society and outside the law. Nevertheless, we found time to comfort each other and to laugh. The Poles had not exactly spoiled us either. We believed and hoped that we would survive the Germans despite their persecution, if they did not kill us directly. Between the frequent Aktionen against Jews, which always ended in the same way, there were quiet periods which sometimes lasted only a few days, but at other times 2 to 3 weeks. The survivors crawled out of their hideouts and primarily used the time for stocking up on food. On those quiet days one saw Polish farmers coming into the Jewish district early in the morning or at night while the Germans were not there. They sneaked into Jewish houses with small packages of food and came out again with bigger packages. Many Jews gave Polish friends their best pieces of clothing, furniture, household goods, or anything they'd been able to save in exchange for something to eat or to have the Poles take care of their belongings until the war was over. These oral agreements were usually made without any guarantees and under the guise of humanity and neighborly love. On one side there was Jewish misery and helplessness, and on the other Polish greed and peasant craftiness. The business of safekeeping until after the war flourished. Heated competition developed between the Polish peasants, each one trying to accumulate more Jewish possessions for later on than the others. Many of these peasant Poles were very poor and lived in misery. Some were still living in chatas with straw roofs, no floors, and sparse or primitive furnitures. They often ate with wooden spoons and slept on straw mattresses with pillows and bedding made of checkered ticking without covers. Their clothes were tattered, often ripped or patched. The only suit and pair of shoes they owned were worn only to church on Sunday. Suddenly, moderately wealthy Jewish homes with good furniture, damask bed linen, real silverware, and modern clothing were open to them, offering riches about which they had never dreamed. For a mere sandwich or a kind word, they could have these desirable items from the hungry and worried Jews. Typical portable Jewish valuables of that time were 2 silver Sabbath candlesticks, plush quilts used for covering the beds, and a gold necklace, which usually was already gone by then. From the very beginning, we Jews were deprived of all gold by the Gestapo, either directly through forced contributions or by means of the Judenrat under the threat of deportation or shooting. These objects belonged to the household and were the status symbol of a Jewish middle-class family. Only in the event of extreme desperation could these items be touched, and desperation was everywhere now. If one were not forced to trade them for a piece of bread, then they were given to the farmers for self-keeping until after the war. One can safely assume today that all such candlesticks and quilts found anywhere in rural Poland today were once Jewish possessions. The numerous poor Jews did not have these problems. Even they possessed Sabbath candlesticks, but they were small and made of brass, and their quilts were not plush. I will never forget a typical scene when Poles wanted to buy or just take the clothes we Jews were wearing. They used the following argument. "Give me the suit you have on. It'll be taken from you soon anyway, before they kill you." Who can imagine how our hearts felt when we heard that? Almost everyone, including my family, entrusted household items and clothing to farmers for safekeeping. When we noticed our mistake, it was too late. When I was the last one of my family who remained, I did not give away a single thing more for safekeeping. I sold everything I could and just left the rest. I have never regretted this decision. Sometimes I was actually proud of it. Very few of these rural Polish saviors were actually helpful. Most of them were merely opportunists. Innumerable Jews were later beaten and murdered by their saviors for their valuables. Today we know these illegally appropriated objects hardly brought joys to the Polish people. Jewish children played a special, almost heroic part in the struggle for daily bread and bare existence. A child could get through more easily and was not recognized as quickly. For that reason, they were often depended upon for finding food. At an early age, they became the breadwinners of the family, and they fulfilled that task perfectly. There were no schools for Jewish children. Books and schools were taboo. It is no exaggeration to say that in a certain sense, there were no children among us. They grew up prematurely and became, in a way, what their parents meant them to be. In the evening after work, if everyone returned home in good health, those who stayed home all day were always thankful and joyous. In numerous families, children went to work to provide for their old and sick parents. These distressed people watched at the window, counting the minutes, waiting hour after hour until they finally had their beloved children back. It was heartbreaking when they returned beaten, wounded, or sometimes not at all. They were satisfied when the youngsters smuggled in some food. They went to bed hungry if food was taken from the children at the gate controller. Every day was a war itself, a battle for one's relatives, life, food, and health. It had never been easy for us, and now it had grown even more difficult. But by comparison with what followed, it was tolerable. We young people gradually organized ourselves and formed a new chevra of about 10 to 12 young boys and girls from a former group, most of whom had stayed in Rajin. As often as possible, especially on Sundays, we met secretly, usually at the Kamenetsky sisters' apartment, who, because they were so-called useful Jews, had a larger apartment than any of the rest of us. The two sisters sewed clothes, underwear, and other things for the SD officials and their wives. In their apartment, we sang our old songs softly and talked and helped each other bear the hardships of life. We discussed all developments and agreed not to get caught in the wake of those who benefited at the cost of others. We thought ahead and even made plans for our future survival. Since Rajin was the county seat and boasted a big castle and several luxurious houses, it became the headquarters of the Gestapo, SD, Gendarmerie, Schutzpolizei, and the county commissioner's office. All of these authorities made enormous demands on the small Jewish community through the Judenrat. The Jewish tasks included cutting wood, carrying water, cleaning toilets, shining boots, providing coal and firewood, maintaining houses, cleaning cars, sweeping roads, grooming horses, burying the dead bodies of the people who were tortured and killed, etc. Beyond that, we repeatedly had to allocate large amounts of money as so-called contributions. We also had to provide coffee, tea, gold, watches, jewelry, underwear, leather, fur coats, boots, suits, butter, eggs, and geese. The last three items had to be contributed several times, for birthdays and holidays, etc. Providing the required goods became increasingly difficult. Jews were not allowed to leave their houses or establish contact with the outside world, not even with the Polish population. The rations allocated to us became ever smaller. For dying, they were too much, yet for living, not enough. Later, they were stopped altogether. Our tormentors made a sport of chasing us out of one apartment and into another. This constant moving to a worse apartment can greatly burden a human being physically and psychologically, since each move entailed losing at least part of one's possessions or irreplaceable valuables which had been hidden. That each change of residence had to be made within a few hours was a matter of course for the Nazis. For us, however, it meant a special hardship. I still remember our big wardrobe, which we never took apart or moved till the Germans marched in. It took us an entire day to disassemble and rebuild it. Later, after having moved so often, we were able to do it within an hour. The massive lower part with the heavy drawers could be opened only while sitting. The upper part was bulky and solid, as were the side walls and the heavy carved doors. Today, such an antique would have great value. In addition to the Nazis, anti-Semites of Polish and Ukrainian origins circled us like vultures, waiting for their prey to die. In Radzin, a Ukrainian mayor was appointed, whose name I do not remember, but whose face I shall never forget. He was emaciated, had thin lips, deeply set small eyes, and never laughed, a fanatical anti-Semite. His character was reflected in his face. Apparently this armchair sadist found his only satisfaction in hating and torturing the Jews. For him, the anti-Jewish Aktionen of the Nazis were neither fast nor strict enough. He had a Polish assistant named Domakowski. Domakowski was a refugee who confiscated an apartment in the Jewish house of the Schumacher family, which was a few houses away from us. He was strong and tough and a practicing anti-Semite. Commissioned by the town, he confiscated Jewish property, including apartments and houses, without the slightest consideration. He literally took everything he desired for himself, regardless of the time of day or night. Whenever he needed or wanted something, he would go to a Jewish home and take it. During the pillages, he often became violent and struck people. It was not so much the confiscated items that interested him, but rather the pleasure he derived from taking them. The mayor and his assistant, Domakovsky, lived from our suffering. The head of the Judenrat tried to tame these two beasts as well, but only with modest success. They intended to keep abreast of the Gestapo. As if we did not have enough problems, we also had to endure sporadic raids from the SS and police units from other areas as well. During one of these raids, my brother was caught and taken away with some others. For a week, we heard not a word from him, nor did we know where he was being held. Finally, we learned that he was in the camp at Belzec, about 120 kilometers south of Rajin. Like Sobibor, Belzec was one of the testing areas for later concentration camps. We tried every possible way to free him, but in vain. After a few weeks, he came back. He had managed to escape under unbelievable circumstances, walking through fields and woods at night and hiding during the day so as not to be discovered. He described the unbelievable tortures which Jews suffered there at the hands of SS sadists. Adolf, or Wolf, about whom he told us, must have been an animal in human form. My brother returned psychologically beaten, dirty, full of lice, half-starved, and dull-witted. But he had returned, and we were overwhelmed with joy. He would need weeks to become a normal person again, but our persecutors did not give us much time. During that period, my friend Zvi Apeloy came to visit. Shortly after the war had broken out, Zvi fled to that part of Poland which was occupied by the Russians. Because he was not able to integrate there, he migrated to the center of Russia. After he became acquainted with the situation in the Russian paradise, he decided, out of desperation, to return home to Radzin. After crossing the river Bug, he arrived in Wlodowa, where the Schutzpolizei and the gendarmerie from Radzin were carrying out an aktion.
The police units which were stationed in Radzin executed daily aktionen against Jews within a radius of about 100 kilometers. We could tell from Zvi's face what he had experienced. It was distorted, and he looked grief-stricken, and his eyes were full of tears. Everything seemed to emerge from within. He could not free himself from the scenes he had witnessed. A mass execution of Jews, men, women, and children. The streets full of blood from the dead and injured lying there. It was unbelievable from the way he described it. Although he had come back to his family out of desperation and had planned to stay with them, he finally decided to return to Russia. By then, it had become difficult to cross the border, but he was lucky. He survived in Russia and is living in Israel today. He told me later in Israel how lucky he was to meet an Austrian from Vienna, a previous social democrat, now a border guard, trying to help Jews. He actually brought him across the border, helping a Jew and acting against Hitler. I was fortunate because I was regarded as a useful Jew. The elder of the Jews had a son, Simon Lichtenstein, who had studied electronics in Paris and had returned shortly before the war broke out. With my manual skills and his connections, we organized ourselves with a common will to survive and became responsible for the electrical work in all the German offices, along with other small jobs. Compared with what others did, my job was not too difficult. It enabled me to earn some money and to organize a few things. The work we did for the Wehrmacht was sometimes paid for by the local paymaster. The Gestapo and diverse police units did not contribute anything. They paid for our work by not killing us, at least not yet. Sometimes, but seldom, we received a piece of bread or meat for performing some special task or in trade. My father lived by means of his contacts with the Polish acquaintances, usually landed proprietors with whom he had previously done business. Some did not forget us and helped purely for humanitarian reasons. Others, however, forgot us. Like other Jews, my father was forced to do anything he could merely to survive. During that period, we were evicted again from our apartment, which was then given to the Nivrozunovsky family. Our whole family was forced to move into a one-room apartment in the same house. Mr. Niewiarzymski, a Pole, was the former director of the local elementary school. Apparently he had good connections with the SD, for soon after Himmler had ordered the schools closed, he was made director of the town's dairy and of the distribution office for tobacco and cigarettes. Those were very high positions during the war, when everything was scarce and rationed, and the black market flourished. A business relationship was established between Niewiarzymski and my father. From time to time, the Pole passed cigarettes to him through an attic door, for which he received money. My father then sold the cigarettes to a middleman, who in turn sold them to somebody else. One day, when several such middlemen were arrested, they revealed their sources. Nothing happened to Mr. Nivrzynski. My father, however, was arrested. On the day of his apprehension, an entire world came to an end for me and my family. I withdrew from everything. When I did not have to work, or after, I immediately hid at home or outside. We did everything possible to obtain my father's release, but all our efforts through the Judenrat, with payments of money and valuables, and all our connections with the corresponding authorities, were in vain. We couldn't get him released. After 2 or 3 weeks, my father was transferred to the prison at Lublin. He was to be tried by a so-called Sondergericht, special court. One of the only two acceptable lawyers in the Sondergericht was the well-known Hofmeckel Ostrowski, who had offices in Warsaw and Krakow. We turned to him, and he agreed to defend my father for a large sum of money. I was chosen to correspond with him because it was impossible to meet him personally. Jews were forbidden to travel.